Welcome to the Ardello Training Podcast. This week, my guest is physical therapist and strength coach, Dr. Mitch Babcock. And he'll tell us about his unique model and approach to physical therapy and how he integrates true strength training into his practice. He also shares key advice and strategies for learning and evolving as a practitioner and coach, including his secret for staying current with the latest research and a lot more. Guys, this is a great interview. I think you're going to love it. And welcome this week to episode number 234 of the Ardello Training Podcast, where this week we will certainly bridge the gaps in strength, performance, and injury prevention. So I am just getting back in the swing of things after the holidays, and we actually did a short vacation up to the mountains. We got to see some snow. My wife, my little girls, we took a couple of days and really enjoyed ourselves out in the cold weather, which we don't get a lot of down here in Florida. So anyway, I hope your holiday season was great and we're off to a great new year. And I hope you're having a great year so far. And I have a great resource that I will actually share with you at the conclusion of the episode of the interview here. So I'll talk a little bit about that before we wrap up. So my guest this week is Mitch Babcock, who I mentioned in the beginning. And if you've heard me talk about a new breed of physical therapist or rehab professional, Mitch is definitely one of those professionals that I'm talking about who effectively and successfully combines rehabilitation, his background as a therapist, and integrates that into a strength training approach. So you're going to hear about that approach and his philosophy and kind of methodology during this session. And he has a very unique and successful business model that you'll hear about as well in this week's show. And it's very different from what I did when I was working as a clinician. So guys, as I'm lining up a great guest list for you this year in 2018, as I always mention, let me know who you'd like to hear or what topics you'd like to hear about, or if you have any questions that you want me to answer here on the show. The best way to get in touch with me is obviously shoot me an email if you'd like, or go to the ardellatraining.com/ask page, and you can post a question or comment or feedback there. And that's been a great community page. So if you haven't checked that out, again, go to ardellatraining.com/ask. So it's great to be back to the show after taking a short break. And again, with the little vacation we had, I really just disconnected for a few days. And I'm kind of getting my sea legs back here now and getting the ball rolling again with a lot of great things that I'm planning and gearing up for in 2018. And quite honestly, I fell a little short in the things that I wanted to do last year. And I am looking forward to take some big steps forward this year. And I'll talk a little bit about that at the end of the episode when I share a great resource with you, a great new resource with you. So stay tuned for that. And as always, guys, let's jump right into the interview. Got a lot of great content here with Mitch. So let's do it. And then I will circle back at the end. Enjoy the session, guys. All right, guys. Dr. Mitch Babcock is a physical therapist, coach, athlete, and teacher of movement. His clinic is Fitness TX, and I'm excited to have Mitch. I'm excited to have you here, man. I think I really appreciate your combination, having the background as a PT and a strength coach. Obviously, that's my background, being a former physio. You caught my eye on social media, and I know you're doing some great things, which we're going to get into here. And let's start out with that, Mitch. Let's talk about your background as an athlete. Maybe where you were as an athlete, and then maybe where you have evolved to today. And then we'll get into the PT stuff as well.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor. Like most listeners, I think we've appreciated your content over a number of years and the guests you've had on. So a long time listener, first time caller, right? Cool, it's good. So my athlete background is super unimpressive, if I'm being honest. You know, just small town high school athlete, you know, You play every sport because there's only a handful of people who play sports, right? But got kind of hooked on the competitive thing. That's just kind of how I always grew up. I credit my high school football coach for really getting me into the weights early. I had a relatively successful football career in school there and opted to not play basketball in lieu of just continuing to train for football. And so I spent a lot of time with my high school football coach in the weight room there and just taught me a lot of lessons about training, the lessons that the barbell teaches people, right, that you come into contact with, that you carry forward in life. So I credit him for a bunch of that, but really didn't really chase anything into college. Just kind of stayed active, stayed into the fitness kind of landscape and kind of drifted around. I didn't really know where I fit competitively. I had lost that competitive kind of that itch. I kind of did some bodybuilding on the side, I guess you could call it, for vanity mostly, but was finishing my degree in exercise science at the time and just kind of exploring a lot of things. And I'm in CrossFit now, but what I would say at the time is that my school was a very ACSM heavy school in their exercises medicine program and very much by the linear periodization model. And this is around about the time where CrossFit was picking up steam, you know, late 2000s, 2009, 10 kind of time. And so I kind of got turned off then by CrossFit because of the variance. I didn't quite understand the methodology then. And it wasn't until grad school when I was really in physio school that I came in contact with some of Kelly Starrett's work and, you know, our friend who I know you've had on the show multiple times and great interviews, by the way. And, you know, came into contact with his work and he opened the door for me to understand, you know, another branch of physio and really also understand from a different lens. You know, he would get talking about why these movements are functional, why taking the hip through full range of motion and taking the shoulder through full range of motion, you know, under load, challenging it under metabolic fatigue was important to the human condition. I was like, man, this makes a whole lot of sense all of a sudden. So it was at that point where I really started pursuing CrossFit as my own training. And I've loved it ever since. It's filled that internal competitive void. And I got a good group of friends that I train with that are, you know, decently, I would say competitive in the local Michigan area. And we have a good time training. And from that, I'm able to kind of help other people train as well. So that's kind of been my progression into where I'm at now, which is pretty exclusively in the CrossFit world.
If you don't mind me taking a step back, just talk about training as an athlete in high school. You're training for football. How was that compared to where you are today in terms of technique, you know, technical proficiency, how you train today versus where you were as an athlete in high school? And did you feel you got a lot of good coaching as a high school athlete?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that at the time, I think it was better than anything else in the area. No, in the sense of, I just think we've learned so much in the last 10 years. I mean, the entire community has taken leaps and bounds as far as strength and conditioning knowledge is concerned. So we were squatting, we were deadlifting, which in a high school is rare, right? Free, you know, barbell back squatting and deadlifting and pressing. And, we would do some unilateral work. Our coach would take us out to the auxiliary gym and have us do a lot of conditioning stuff, take us out to the track and have us do a lot of conditioning work. But never tie the pieces together like some of the new strength coaches are able to do. You know, why squatting is important for hip function, why front squatting is important to a football player, you know, being able to keep an upright torso, why these things matter so that when you go out there on the field of play that you have these positions and you're understanding how to create force from that. You know, that's just the next level stuff, right? Right. And along with that, the injury prevention stuff, right? Why do we want knee position to track over the toe and not on the instep? You know, why do we want the shoulder in a solid position overhead? That's just the stuff that we missed out on. But at the same time, like, man, we were getting a lot of it right in the sense of move a barbell, try, you know, moving some power cleans the best that we could and things of that nature. So I think with that being said, I've done a lot to try to go back to my old high school and try to like, you know, like impart some of this stuff like, hey, guys, you're doing a lot of this right, but let me fill in the gaps a little bit for you from that sense.
So do you think it's maybe the educational component as far as educating athletes on why move this way?
As humans, we want to know the why, right? And the start with why kind of the theme that's out there in the world. And that makes so much sense. And I try to do that with my athletes here in CrossFit. You know, the adults that are coming in my program, I'm trying to tell them the why behind the workout of the day so that they're not guessing as to what it could be. And I'm just upfront with them. And teenagers and high school athletes are no different in that sense too. Like, guys, I understand you are here because you want to be really good on the field. This is why this matters. So let me deliver that on the front end. Yeah. And I think, like you said, educating athletes, but educating the coaches as well. Absolutely. You know, we've always just kind of trained because we knew that was what we were supposed to do or to get our athletes stronger. But I think the coaches need a lot of help as well as to connecting the dots as to why that stuff matters.
Okay. So let's move into the physical therapy stuff, and this whole conversation will kind of blend the two things together.
Perfect.
Why did you become a PT? What is your story there?
Again, ultra unimpressive. I think that's the thing. But if I'm being honest, I as I was floating through my undergrad, my first year undergrad, I was an undecided major. I can remember vividly in a communications class, and they told us, give a 5-minute talk on anything that you want. And I picked the importance of the effect of exercise on disease, right, or something like that. And my professor pulled me aside and said, you know, there's an exercise science program on campus here, right? And I had no idea that was even a thing that I could pursue. Got into exercise science before I really had a plan with it. Discovered that PT was a graduate program with really steady, you know, really solid career choice. And I was like, well, I'll go into grad school for physical therapy, not having any clue whatsoever. Most people will tell you a story. I went through PT, really liked it, and that's why I became a PT. Not at all the case for me. Literally zero exposure to physical therapy. Wow. And decided that that's where I was going to do. So started doing all the work and pulling the grades and getting the extra hours and got into grad school. And it was in year one, semester one, when I kind of had a quarter life crisis, I guess I tell a lot of people, of like, you know, you start doing a lot more observation hours. You're starting to see that a lot of these clinics feel, look, behave a lot the same. Unfortunately, I wasn't around a ton of, you know, top tier, you know, outpatient ortho clinics, which there are a bunch in this, in around the world and around the country. Yeah. I just wasn't exposed to that kind of level of physical therapy. And I was just starting to panic a little bit, like, man, I don't know if I can do this, you know, mill type outpatient ortho stuff my whole career. This is not what I feel in my heart like I want to do. I felt more driven towards the fitness aspect of things. And, you know, it was guys like Kelly, guys like yourself who are really out there as these hybrids, you know, trying to say, hey, the conditioning, the fitness is important, and we can blend the two and we can do it in some unorthodox ways. That kind of gave me some motivation.
It's interesting. I'll just touch on this real quick. But I mean, that my story was, I was involved in physical therapy. So I went through PT and I'm like, oh, this is kind of cool. So it's funny that you said you didn't have that process. It was very different, but
I heard it from so many people. They would always be like, oh, I rehabbed an ACL. And that's when I decided.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh. Yeah. All right. So you graduate PT school, mm-hmm. you come out. What was your first, your job coming out?
On my own.
Wow.
Literally wow. Haven't worked for no one else since grad school and started my own clinic. And I take a lot of slack for that. You know, it, and for good reason. I think that's all well intended of becoming a good practitioner, studying under someone, having a mentor, getting your hands on a lot of patients and getting a lot of repetitions. And I do not disagree with that. It just wasn't my calling. What I felt compelled to do and what I was always felt in grad school was trying to blend this approach of getting in a training environment, because I felt like they were the people doing it right, of getting people moving, getting people under load, changing their lives through fitness, and just being someone to aid in that process of when things get in the way. Don't go see an orthopedic who's going to tell you to stop doing the thing you love. Don't go see someone who doesn't understand your training, right, doesn't understand your hobbies and passions, and more or less come alongside those athletes and try to do that. And CrossFit fit that bill for me and my own personal training. It was taking a lot of heat in the other direction. Stop doing CrossFit. And I wanted to be a resource somewhere. And that was just kind of my drive. And I knew that I'm the type of person that it's a good way to introspect here, but I have a hard time taking orders in a direction that I don't believe I should be going. Right. Yeah. And so I tend to clash heads a little bit and in that sense, but that's okay. Right. There's a lot of us out there like right. that. So, and I knew that if I didn't do it early, right, when I didn't have a lot of responsibilities, I didn't have a mortgage or a child or a family to provide for, that it was a good time to roll the dice on that and really try to carve out something that was meaningful to me. So that's kind of what made me head in that direction right out of school.
So your first clinic was, is it the same clinic you have now? The fitness?
Fitness DX. Yep. Yeah. I started that. It was up and running within 2 months after graduating school. Okay. I had a little 8-foot by 14-foot room inside of a CrossFit gym here in Michigan. Wow. And, that's where I got up and started, man, a treatment table off Amazon, a few supplies I knew I needed. I had a few good mentors that kind of guided me in a good direction of your basics, LLCs, bank accounts, things of that nature. Sure. Get a website started and man, just like on your own, right? Talk about being dropped in the jungle. That's kind of what it felt like.
Now, how do you take insurance plans or anything like that? Or
I'm still 100% cash pay.
Okay.
I do the situation I'm in now that I'm a full-time gym manager, of a gym across town than I started at. They're sister affiliates essentially. But I've stepped into a full-time management role, where I'm overseeing a lot of the coaching, the development, and the training there. And then my practice is 100% out of that location as well. So 100% cash pay. And then I kind of have this system set up where the members of our gym, of our affiliate have access to my treatments at a discounted rate. And you can look at that as sort of your CrossFit insurance, essentially, right? You pay a membership to be a part of our gym, and thus you just need to pay a copay, quote unquote, right, to get access to treatment, right? So discounted for the members so that we can take care of them, so that there's not a large barrier to entry, so that I don't have to run into the same person who's battling the same shoulder injury, who doesn't feel like they can access my care because of a paywall that may exist. So that's kind of been the setup, 100% cash pay. Yeah. For the last year and a few months now.
What are the big challenges with that, with a cash paying clinic?
It's so new in a lot more, a lot of other therapists are moving to that model. Uh-huh. And not to say that it's the model to move to. I think it's just another avenue for folks to kind of step out and practice the way they want to practice. I think for me, I needed that time with people. I needed that full hour. You know, that was kind of lucrative of being able to set my price and set my time.
Yeah, sure.
You know, one of the barriers is just, it's just new for people to feel like they have insurance and to be paying into a large insurance premium, you know, that they are, and to not be able to access or not, you know, feel like they can't use it. And that's just a lack of knowledge on behalf of a lot of the consumers in our healthcare environment, right? Not knowing really what their insurance provides, what their deductible is, what their copay is, and having to meet that deductible and really essentially be paying cash until then anyways. Yeah. And so when you kind of spell it out to folks as kind of why you made that decision, why you provide the care you do, and kind of what made you go in that direction, it kind of makes it a little easier. But there's been a lot of conversations I've had to have with folks kind of explaining that rationale.
What do you think is kind of the current state? What's the perception? I mean, you're in the game. I'm not a clinician mm-hmm. anymore. So do you see this kind of evolving over time where, you know, more therapists are going to follow the model that you've adopted?
Yes and no. I don't think it's the end all be all. I don't think that we can realistically think that all physical therapy is going to go to a cash pay model and people are going to be, you know, super happy with that. I think in niche markets, you're going to see more and more of physio stepping into a very subset group, like I just treat martial artists or something and cash pay in that division, or I'm a running specific therapist and I'm stepping into a cash pay model. I think you'll see more of that. The current state, you know, the pulse that I've been around in the folks that I talk to, the third party reimbursement is just not what it used to be, right? It's just, you know, I've heard the term, it's a sinking ship, and that's not to say there's still not money to be made in that model, you know, as a business owner, there's a lot of them doing it. But it's getting harder and harder to produce quality outcomes, given the time domains, given the reimbursement loops that you have to jump through. So it's getting harder and harder. And, I don't foresee it shifting. I don't foresee insurers all of a sudden deciding to reimburse more per the treatments that we're providing and the outcomes that we're doing. The research is in our favor, though. It continues to show that exercise and skilled manual therapy, when dosed appropriately and graded exposure to movements and the things that we provide as physical therapists, get the best outcomes at a much lower risk than surgery and pharmaceuticals that we're up against. And the more and more evidence comes out against the opioid addiction, the pharmaceutical problems that we face as a country, the more and more people are going to shift and start looking for another option. Yeah. So that's in our favor. What's not is that third party reimbursement model. And so the question there exists of like, okay, how do we access your care and still make it affordable to the consumer? You know, I got a shout out to a couple mentors of mine and close colleagues, Mike Eisenhart, who's a physical therapist in the New Jersey area, and Jeff Moore, who's a physical therapist out in Colorado and a mentor of mine. And they're working diligently, Mike specifically, with a more health promotion therapy type division. And you can look that up if anyone's interested, any other physical therapist, the APHPT, which is Applied Prevention Health Promotion Therapies, right? Other therapists and clinicians who are stepping out and kind of working in a model to take care of the health of populations of people. And what they mean by that is, you know, you can look at that as corporations, you can look at that as subset populations, but stepping in to say an employer who's self-insured and who's bleeding at the seams, literally on the verge of putting themselves out of business with their insurance coverage and their health expenditures at the end of the year, and stepping in as that party's, you know, health therapist, health clinician, to really oversee and manage the health, and not just musculoskeletal treatment. That's one of them, you know, saving the ER, you know, visits, but also looking at nutrition. You know, what do we know about nutrition and productivity? What do we know about nutrition and the incidence of chronic low back pain? What do we know about risk factors? And, you know, you got Sue sitting in the office who's got 5 risk factors and she's a smoker. You know that she's about to cost you a ton of money. And so guys like Mike are on the front end doing a ton of work to try to spearhead that and to really make it so that clinicians like us who have a really health-minded sense can step in and manage a population of folks, you know, save the company and corporation a lot of money, make a successful career for yourself doing it, and overall have a fulfilling career, which is important. So big shout out to them guys. And I think to your question of where do I think the future is going, I think that's definitely something that needs to be considered as to how we manage the health of this country.
Mitch, talk about the volume of patients on a busy day. What does that look like for you? I'm sure it's very different compared to when I was a clinician. I was in kind of the mill that you described earlier, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And that's really why I left, is I got burnt out. So what is a high volume day for you? And what is it? What is a typical day in your clinic and gym?
Yeah. And this is going to shock a lot of people. High volume day is under 10. It's, you know, six, maybe 8 at the most.
Yeah.
In a typical day is anywhere from 2 to 4,
okay,
you know, clients a day, in addition to my coaching hours and the other things that are on my calendar. But, you know, average day, 3 to 4 clients.
Which is great, you know, because I'm sure that you feel like you're giving 100% high quality care. You're not, you know, you're not having another patient show up at the same time that you're working, you know, and trying to juggle all these patients at once. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, you deal with in the high volume ortho clinics.
So exactly.
That's and awesome.
And being that I practice right in the gym, my treatments may look like, you know, very on the table, you know, like low level exercises, manual therapy, you know, some soft tissue work, maybe manipulation. It may look like a personal training session, depending on what that individual needs. We may be looking at their overhead press. We may be dissecting their, you know, their deadlift. I had a client the other day and they couldn't tell if they were there for open gym or if they were my client, because they were deadlifting up to, you know, 400 pounds and we were detailing stuff out of their deadlift up through that. So, you know, that's the luxury that I get to have is really take that individual. Look, you're buying my time right now as a clinician and a coach,
right,
and we'll see what you need most. You know, if it's more coaching, that's what we'll do. If it's more clinician, you know, we'll step into that realm as well. So I really love it. You know, I spend a lot of mornings coaching the early classes, you know, get the lights on at the gym, coach the 5:45, 7, 9 o'clock class, a few clients in there at the 8 to 10 o'clock hour, the noon hour, maybe a couple in the evening that get in after work. And then it's all hands on CrossFit and fitness otherwise.
Talk about the types of injuries that you see. I'm curious. I mean, what types of musculoskeletal injuries are you most commonly seeing?
I think that's on par with the national average, right? Of shoulders, low backs, knees, you know, that's kind of your basic outpatient ortho stuff. And I see a lot of that in the CrossFit realm as well. That's what the literature would tell you. Most commonly injured areas for CrossFit athletes are the shoulder, low back, and knee. I see predominantly a lot of shoulders, a lot of rotator cuff tendinopathy type dysfunction, bicep tendinopathy sort of thing. Where we're doing a lot of progressive loading, where we're getting individuals in positions where we can modify their symptoms and then continue to load that shoulder, where we pull back certain movements that are aggravating, supplement other movements that are less symptomatic for them. Acute low back stuff, you know, where we're where we're, you know, maybe flexion intolerant, shear intolerant, where deadlifts are starting to bother folks, and we're trying to modify workouts and get them continuing to train and get the stimulus of which they seek, but also being cognizant of kind of their symptoms at the time. So that's predominantly what I see a lot of. And then a wide variety, you know, as most therapists are accustomed to within that too.
Mitch, did you say, were you a coach prior to becoming a physical therapist?
No, officially no. Okay. I didn't. I started my CrossFit coaching right at the same time that I finished physical therapy school.
All right. Well, so my question was going to be, how do you think having the background, the education as a PT, a DPT, changes and influences what you do as a coach, as a movement teacher? That's like a big question, right? I mean,
yeah, it is. And what I would say is that's not to say that I didn't train folks and didn't do it, but I didn't do it, I guess, professionally, right? I didn't do it as my source of income prior to physio school. But it definitely changes your outlook because, you know, when you're primarily in the coaching world, your eyes are so set on performance and you're so hungry to see your clients succeed in performance that you sometimes move that ball a little quicker than it should. And when you have the bias as a physical therapist, when you're on the table with folks, you see the other end of it. You see the people who have come to me and they're like, I miss training, but I can't do these things. They're killing me. You know, they're hurting my shoulder. They're hurting my back. And it becomes more of a less of like, you need to move. What things can we do to get you to move? And I don't care what the workout on the board is. I don't care what your programming may have written out for you. Even if you come in and just do some intervals on the assault bike, I'm happy with that. And so you meet somewhere in the middle then as a coach and clinician who are like, look, I am happy to see all of you succeed, but I'm also very content taking it slowly and seeing small minor gains if it means it's going to keep you in the game longer, right? You kind of pump the brakes a little bit. And I think coaches who have been in the game long enough also have that mindset. They have seen people kind of race ahead too quickly, get out in front of their skis a little bit, and then have a little setback that holds them back from further progress. And you're more content with an athlete coming in and saying, listen, I know you could probably snatch more weight, but 5 pounds is all you're going to go up by. And then next week, I know you can snatch more weight, but we're going to go another 5 pounds. And taking a slow linear progression like that, and over time, let your body adapt, let the neural circuits kind of take hold and become a better mover over time with that.
Let's go back to your physical therapy educational experience. How many were in your class, Mitch?
68, 69.
Okay.
It was about a big class.
That's about the same size as my class. Nice. How many people in your class were like you, that had the background as an athlete, that had knowledge of strength, conditioning?
Oh man, there was a handful, and I say us guys because those are the ones that I hung out with close. There's seven or eight of my close buddies. You know, a handful of them had the CSCS background, had played some sports, were active guys.
So that's pretty good.
And that's not to leave out some other the ladies in our class as well who also had their CSCS. I was just super close with that core group of guys that I was with, and I know some of them have pursued, you know, sport specific outpatient ortho clinics, but their general, you know, mill setting is as well. So there was a handful that we would have discussions, and I can vividly remember in 2013 when I got Kelly Starrett's Supple Leopard book and I brought it in. I'm like, you guys got to check this out. Like, you got to find them on YouTube. And we were doing banded distractions in the lab after hours, and our professor's like, what are you guys doing? And we're like, we're opening up our hips, I think. And, we were diving deep into it, but yeah, I can remember a handful of us.
Do you think there's, I guess where I was leading to with this is, do you think there's a gap in, strength education in the PT curriculum? Could that be improved, or is that
absolutely
just, okay?
Absolutely, and it gets discussed frequently. I get this question a lot of do you think the CSCS is mandatory? Do you think PT school should be spending more time it's a tough question. It's a double-edged sword. I get the ringers that PT schools are up against. They need to make us competent clinicians in the matter of 2.5 years, send us out for good clinical rotations, and they got to make us pass the boards. And until the boards demand that we know more about tissue loading
and hypertrophy and strength ranges as far as loading, yeah. will the PT schools be able to implement it? So the change is going to be slow, but without a doubt it's missing, because as a profession, we have a tendency to chronically underload our patients. And we see that across the board, across all age demographics. Our older populations, our geriatrics, are not getting loaded to the extent that they should. Our active populations are not being loaded to the extent at which they leave our clinics and go train for. I can tell you numerous stories of clients who will swing a 53-pound kettlebell in the gym and go get PT and be told to swing a 10-pound kettlebell and be told that they're strengthening. And we're just missing the mark on so many avenues of really what does strength adaptation look like. And there are so many resources available to us now that you can seek this out on your own time, right? You don't need a S&C background. You don't need to spend time as a college strength coach to really have these fundamental, you know, there's guys like Greg Knuckles and other therapists like Scott Morrison. There's folks that are putting out good content as, you know, how to integrate strength and loading into our rehab, that we could be taking that upon ourselves and not relying on the PT school to have to provide it for us. But that gap is eventually going to have to be filled. We can't be missing the mark for this long.
So you think it's up to the PT, to the clinician that doesn't have that background, to really go out and get it, to learn from some of the sources that you mentioned?
I think so. And that's kind of that Jocko extreme ownership mentality, right? It's just like at the end of the day, the buck stops with us. Yeah. And so we can sit around and blame the system for not providing certain things and this and that, and that's fine. And change will happen slow and we'll still miss the mark on a lot of folks. But if I could tell anyone, just like, go, you know, you don't even need to buy the Essentials of Strength and Conditioning textbook. You can get out there and start reading. So like, what's a loading program that's going to lead to strength adaptations? Understand concepts of specificity and progressive overload. Understand how to program for hypertrophy and start to integrate into rehab mindset.
What would be a specific resource? You mentioned the textbook. I mean, is there something else, maybe more simple?
There's some open text stuff from like Dan Lorenz, a great world-class strength physio out of the Kansas City area. He joined up with Mike Ryman and put out an open source essentials of strength and conditioning for rehab professionals. Okay. And that's an open source text that folks can go and download. And that's going to break down stuff that strength coaches know by the back of the hand. You know, what are rep ranges for hypertrophy, how to go about strengthening and some of these basic fundamentals. That's a really good starting point. And like I said, it's open source. So go hit the PubMed for it and download it. But then there's guys like, you know, Juggernaut, who's putting out content on YouTube, and guys like Mike Isratel, who's wrote books on, you know, e-downloads for $9.99 or $19.99, just some cheap resources that have a ton of high valuable content to them that you can kind of get your mind get your head in the mind of a strength coach rather, and then start kind of backfilling, connecting the dots there from how you would put that into your rehab.
Excellent. I'll see if I can find the reference that you mentioned and maybe put it in the show notes for the episode.
Yeah. If not, I'll send it over your way after the show, Scott.
Okay. What do you do? What's the most important thing you do to stay current, to keep your S&C education kind of on the cutting edge?
I keep a pulse on some of the other guys who are really leading the way. You know, shout out a lot of names. We've talked about Kelly. We talked about guys like Quinn Hennock out there with Clinical Athlete. He's doing a lot to really impart like, hey, let's get back to the evidence. You know, we got away from that for a while with a lot of the voodoo tricks and the magic and the placebo. Let's get back to what really works. And at the end of the day, that typically falls on tissue loading, right? And we see that a lot. So trying to keep a pulse on other big players in the field. And then also, I teach a Con Ed course for other physical therapists, and there's no other way to push yourself to trying to stay up on that literature than going out and trying to teach to other physical therapists who are up on that literature. Right. So that'll motivate you to get your butt in gear in that sense. So that's been hugely helpful for going out there and trying to seek out the content and integrate the information into my practice.
What is the course that you teach, and is that through, is it PT on Ice?
Yeah, correct. So, okay. So Jeff Moore, who I've cited before, a mentor of mine, started the Institute of Clinical Excellence, which you can find there on ice.physio or as you mentioned, PT on Ice. physicaltherapy.com. So the Institute of Clinical Excellence, it's a physical therapy con ed company, striving towards what we claim as building physical therapists 2.0, right? And the problems that we're sitting here and discussing, right? What's been missing? We need a new age therapist who's on the current edge of what orthopedic manual, physical therapists need to know, and how to deliver great outcomes in this current environment, given the emerging evidence. And so there's a number of courses that Jeff and the team that we've assembled, from cervical spine management, lumbar management, thrust manipulation, pain management, extremity management, bike fit, injured runners, the treatment of the dancer. I teach a course for the fitness athlete, essentially CrossFit athletes. We do two different types of courses. We do an online version and a live version. And within our online division, we have an essential concepts where physical therapists, whether they're new, whether they've been practicing a number of years, who admittedly have no knowledge of the barbell. And when a client comes in and they say, I have pain with my snatch, they have no idea what a snatch is. We take them from 0 to 100 in that online course of dissecting the essential fundamental movements that you're going to find in CrossFit. And then we have an advanced concepts course where we take clinicians who are like, look, I want to make this CrossFit space my niche and my main source of revenue. And we'll dissect more into gymnastics, into Olympic lifting, into business principles, et cetera. And then in our live course, we try to put the hands-on learning. We try to put the learning into movement and get therapists to move. And I think if we really step back and examine ourselves as movement experts, I think a lot of us miss the buck with moving ourselves. And we'd like to sit in our armchairs and think that we know what running good running technique is without having ran ourselves, and what good lifting technique is without having lifted ourselves. And so we can really connect those dots a little bit and put barbells in clinicians' hands and try to teach them some of the lessons that we as strength coaches have learned from a number of years of just being under the barbell ourselves. So I'm really, really proud of those courses. I teach them alongside Zach Long, the barbell physio, you may know. With his strong social media presence, and my colleague Ryan Smith, who's out in the Baltimore area. So that we head up that fitness athlete division, all part of the Institute of Clinical Excellence.
And that's just for clinicians, correct?
Yeah, physical therapists and chiropractors. And okay. With our fitness athlete courses, we have had a lot of coaches, advanced coaches, who've wanted to step in. Admittedly, we say, look, there may be a little content here that's a little out of reach. Yeah. And as long as they're cool with that, we welcome coaches who are on the cutting edge and want to step into that space as well.
Talk about and you mentioned this a couple of times, I think, but kind of the manual techniques. I'm just kind of curious, what are some of the manual techniques that you use in your clinic?
Yeah, I do. I like to integrate a lot of PNF stuff. So if I'm going to do a lot of soft tissue work, I'm trying to integrate as much contract, relax as I can. And there's a lot of different terminologies for this, essentially, right? You'll hear a lot of end range isometrics. You'll hear a lot of cars and pails and rails, right? With some of these other methodologies that are coming out there, of just trying to get the body to create strength around its end ranges, right? And so we can do some soft tissue contract relax to try to expose, say, the shoulder to new ranges of internal rotation, and then try to create maximal contraction around that end range that we've now created so that the body can learn to adapt and try to own those positions. So I do like to use a lot of soft tissue combined with some end range contractions there, call it what you will. I use some basic kind of manual therapy Mulligan principles of some joint arthrokinematics. I use manipulation techniques around the cervical, thoracic, lumbar, spine when some general evidence tells us they may be efficacious, right? Some acute, say, neck pain or neck-related headaches where a cervical manipulation has some evidence that it may be useful. Maybe it's an acute bout of low back pain where that individual still has good hip internal rotation moment, and we can tell that that's not really a chronic long-stemming issue. We're going to go ahead and utilize a lumbar manipulation technique and then couple that with some really graded exposure through movement and loading and that. So kind of a combination approach with the manual therapy, but ultimately trying to get that individual back to moving. And so if we can just do some things, whether that be to, some people have said the window of opportunity to get them moving, then so be it, but we'll leverage it.
So it sounds like movement is the primary approach, and then the manual techniques and things are kind of the secondary supplemental.
Yeah. And we can look at them as a symptom modification tool. Guys like Jeremy Lewis, who's provided us with the shoulder symptom modification procedure, right? Where we go in and we try to alter maybe humeral position. We try to alter thoracic position. Maybe we try to alter scapular position and see if any of those modify the pain going on at the glenohumeral joint. And if they do, maybe we're going to couple that with a little bit of a scapular upward rotation, manual therapy, and then boom, putting weight in someone's hand and getting them in maybe a prone or sideline position where they need to take ownership over that scapular range of motion. And now we're loading that shoulder through a pain-free range of motion that they walked in, you know, painful shoulder flexion, they can walk out with pain-free shoulder flexion. So that's ultimately the goal of trying to use some manual therapy techniques to modify symptoms and then get that individual moving under some load.
Your education in movement in physical therapy school, satisfactory or unsatisfactory?
Unsatisfactory.
Okay. And I talk about that.
I say that with no hesitation, right?
But yeah. I didn't expect that actually.
that's not to like take a shot at it. I love my education. I love a lot of my professors that work their butts off to try to deliver the content. But when you define movement to me, you know, I want a lab that's breaking out the squat. And for a number of reasons. Why? Because I have a geriatric population that needs to sit and stand off a chair, and I have a youthful population that needs to know how to barbell back squat safely. You know, so in those have some overlap between their safety, their efficiency, and their efficiency. So that needs to be addressed, in my opinion. We need to have a lab looking at, you know, gait technique as well as running technique, right? So extrapolating that out to just, you know, moving that dial a little bit further on the performance continuum and what's good running technique look like. And as a result, I've just kind of outsourced it. You know, I've put myself in positions or in groups rather where we can have these discussions, these online platforms, mentorship groups, where I can come in contact with guys like Chris Johnson out in Seattle, who's a world-class therapist and works a lot with runners and triathletes, right? And he can deliver some content with best current evidence about, you know, what's step rate, what's cadence look like, what's stride length look like, what do we need to modify and change with someone to be a more efficient and safe runner, you know? And so those are the things that I wish the school would have hit, but I understand why it's so hard, or I understand why it's hard to outsource that information and to try to fit it in the schedule in which they're up against.
So you learn the most about movement through outside courses.
Correct.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. And courses are not just kind of being, like I said, being in networks where we're able to kind of, you know, pick the brains of some world-class clinicians, you know?
If you had to give one big piece of advice to really get a great base of understanding for movement, what do you recommend? Like what's step one?
Oh man.
To learn good movement?
That is tough. I guess, So Greg Cook's done such a great job, right, of trying to, you know, spear that direction, trying to lead the way there and carve out a path for us to really start having a conversation around movement. So buy that textbook and flip through it. You know, that's gonna do a lot to get your head in the right gear. But ultimately, when we start defining movement, it's gonna be within context of what's important to you. You know, if you want to have a sound understanding of weightlifting, there's some really good weightlifting texts that you need to, you know, pick up or get around a really good experienced weightlifting coach, and understand that. If your world is more CrossFit, I think Kelly's done a great job with his Supple Leopard book of trying to, you know, dissect some of those movements. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just a number of resources that it would be hard to pick one, but really understanding your niche would help you a ton, right?
Yeah.
Understanding if I want to work specifically with runners, there's going to be things that are more important to me than to someone who's working with CrossFitters. Yeah. While there is some overlap, there's some other nuances there that I'm going to want to hit.
I think that's great advice. I mean, I think movement is a great place to start. It's a really heavy book. I mean, it's a lot mm-hmm. of content there.
Very theoretical at times.
Yep. You also said that, you know, it's context specific depending on what you want to learn. So whether it's weightlifting or basic barbell lifts or kettlebells or running or anything else, there's just fantastic resources out there. So awesome. Let me ask you this, as a coach, what do you consider your area of specialization as a coach?
I love to teach the barbell movements and I love to demystify them or, not make them as intimidating as people may have thought them to be. And a lot of people, if you're not in the CrossFit environment regularly, you have this idea that CrossFit is full of Rich Fronings and Dan Baileys and guys that are going to the CrossFit games. And the reality is the 15,000 affiliates that are out there, you know, those are the 1% of the 1%, right? And the 99.9% are regular everyday folks who are trying to stay healthy, who got an hour of their day and they're trusting us to plan it for them. They want to come in, they don't want to think, they want to get a good workout in, they want to sweat, and they don't much care about ring muscle ups for time. They care about getting a good workout in for the day. And so a lot of those folks have never touched a barbell before. I was just out to dinner last night. A couple of our long-term members took all of us coaches out to dinner to kind of say thanks around the holidays. And it was a great gesture, had a great time. But they told us, you know, before CrossFit, I had never touched a barbell. And these are guys that move, you know, 225 for, you know, a split jerk, you know? So I'm like, man, you're like, what are you talking about? You've never touched a barbell. And they're like, yeah, before CrossFit, I had zero exposure to weightlifting. And so taking that into context as a coach of like, you know, a deadlift has got a scary name to begin with, trying to demystify that. Say, guys, listen, we're going to pick stuff up off the ground with a flat back and we're going to do it safely. And we're going to call that a deadlift. And don't be intimidated because I got a training barbell here that only weighs 12 and a half pounds or whatever it weighs, right? And so even though it looks scary like a barbell, you can lift it with one hand if you needed to, and that's where we're going to start. And when you see someone come in with this expectation that it's super intimidating and they leave feeling super accomplished and they're like, you know, it's like they just ran a marathon or something. Like, I just deadlifted today. I'm like, yeah, that's awesome. And that to me is really fun and somewhere that I like to strive for. And admittedly, man, I, as a specialty, as a characteristic or as a coaching characteristic, I like to have a great time, right? I live by the model, like Pat Sherwood always says in CrossFit, of make it their best hour of their day, right? And I will humiliate myself. I will dance and sing and be a fool if that's what it takes for someone to come in the door, forget about their stressful work day, forget about trying to get the kids off to school in time. And so they can have fun in that 1 hour, do some lifting, do some fitness, and get on with the rest of their day or the rest of their evening. So I love to make people laugh and smile and kind of sneak the fitness in on top of that.
So maybe summarize this. What do you like the most about CrossFit? And then what, if anything, do you dislike about CrossFit?
I love the ever evolving challenge that is CrossFit, right? No matter how good you are, no matter what physical skills you possess, there's always going to be something that you're weak at and you're going to be striving for, right? And my experience with, you know, a little bit that bodybuilding was and a little bit that powerlifting was kind of like, you know, a singular domain, and you can get burned out of that so quick, you know, whether you reach the top or you realize you're never going to reach the top. It's kind of hard to stay motivated with something like that. In something like CrossFit, there is always something to be had, and there are so many marks of success, you know. Awesome, you just PR'd your back squat. We're going to run a 5K tomorrow. It's like, holy crap. Like check another box off the list. Like, that's my first ever 5K. Great, that's a PR, you know, outstanding. And now tomorrow we're doing handstand pushups. Well, I've never done a handstand. Well, great, got something else to learn. So I love all of that because it keeps people coming back. It keeps them engaged, you know, neurologically and physically into their training program. So I love that. And I think at the same time, that can also be a burden, right? And so you asked me what I hate about it. And it's very hard to take someone with a low level of, you know, base level of conditioning and base level of strength and expose them to so many domains. And it becomes a lot of work on behalf of the coach to be a phenomenal scaler for your individuals. I think more so than anything as a CrossFit coach, your number one job is to scale people appropriately. And, you know, we talked about this at our coaches meeting. It can be tough and you can feel like a bad coach telling someone to scale a workout when in reality, you're a bad coach if you don't. You know, we have the responsibility as coaches to keep our members safe. And when we understand that they're not ready for a certain movement, you know, they're not ready to snatch. So you're going to do overhead squats instead. You know what I mean? And I need to be the one to step up and say and make that decision for them. And that goes in so many different avenues in the workouts that we do. And I think that's one of the biggest barriers. You see CrossFit pushing it a ton. They have a couple different online scaling courses that you can go through to kind of be a better coach in the sense of scaling workouts for your members.
But I think that's priority, understanding like, hey, this individual needs to have a good air squat before we start teaching them how to back squat. Right. Yeah. And then, and kind of holding that line in a sense.
I mean, scaling is really the art of coaching. You know, it's looking mm-hmm. at the individual and looking at the differences between individuals and adjusting accordingly.
Absolutely.
So let's, this kind of leads into the next question about, preventing injury. And so knowing what you know as a clinician and as a coach, what would be your biggest tips, I guess, to prevent injury in strength training? What are the common things you see, I guess?
Yeah, it's overdoing. It's over-voluming. And a couple pieces of literature that will help to put this in context is some literature coming out from Tim Gabbett. And he's, and of course with this, he's looking at rugby players, but it's something that we cite often because it's such a good concept to understand, is the acute to chronic training ratio, right? And we've seen this come out more. It's a U-shaped curve, and there's a sweet spot there for how much an individual is doing within a given week and how much they've done within that given month, right? We want to progress them slowly and linearly, and we don't want to see any one week kind of get super out of whack, right? Where there was a sudden dosage of, say, squatting volume, and now all of a sudden I've got anterior knee pain. So we want to keep that training load between acute to chronic in check, which essentially, if we're simplifying it, just means progress slowly and kind of keep your eye on volume. And the other thing is that when we look at injuries in CrossFit specifically, the injury incidence is low and comparable to other forms of recreational training, citing running, weightlifting, powerlifting as comparable injury rates. And that's contrary to what society and kind of the public would lead you to believe, is that the injury rate in CrossFit is super high. And it's just not what we're finding in the literature. What we do find in the literature is that, you know, there are certain risk factors for injury in CrossFit. One of them being male, you know, sorry, gentlemen, we're at a higher risk, which I find to be hilarious, really, because I think that's a code word for saying ego is a risk factor for getting injured in CrossFit, which is a common thing where we should think about. But two being training experience of the individual, weekly training hours of that individual, and volume, right? And so the individual who tends to be more competitive, who tends to be putting more hours in the gym, who tends to be doing more work, is at a greater risk for injury. And that's simply just saying that their volume is getting out of check, right? You saw this a lot with, if we flash back to the CrossFit regionals a year ago, and we saw the ring dip workout, and it was also coupled with muscle ups in regionals. And you can think about when those workouts were released, you know, a couple of weeks prior to regionals, and all those regional athletes all of a sudden started doing a ton of ring dip volume and a ton of muscle up volume in preparation for the games. And then you had a handful of them. I think the number was greater than six athletes or so that were injured during ring dips. And they had pec tears, and everyone's like, what's the reason for all these pec tears? All of a sudden, and there's speculation on the, you know, the dip and the straps length and the this and the that. And while we'll never know for sure, it makes a whole lot of sense given the evidence that's out there around acute to chronic training loads and around monitoring our training volume, that these athletes had a sudden spike in volume and that led to injury. Right. And so I think when we're trying to be conscious coaches in the CrossFit sphere, being really comfortable progressing our people slowly and keeping an eye on the overall volume that they're doing. It's really easy for an athlete to come in and get gung-ho about CrossFit, and they want to go 5 days a week, and they want to hit every open gym, and they want to do the weightlifting hours after hours. And it's a lot of work to tell them no, you know, to get out of the freaking gym. You don't need it yet. I need you to go hard for this one workout a day for a long time and get comfortable in that intensity kind of piece and with your mechanics before we start talking about dosing your volume higher, just as to keep a pulse on the injury rate.
So too much volume, maybe lack of recovery, and then yeah. Make sure to progress slowly.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the literature there. I'm curious, what journals do you read, and how do you try to keep current with research in rehab or strength and conditioning?
I gotta be honest. I cite social media for this.
Okay.
And this comes back to just like surrounding yourself in a network of other clinicians that you trust.
Yeah.
And man, Facebook and Twitter has done more for me to share articles, literally hand feed them to me.
Yeah.
And whether that be it's just the abstract and I can go peel the full text later, or, but like I said, having a good network of people you trust
And then you're just kind of sharing the literature as it comes out. And, you know, I've went to CSM a handful of times, you know, trying to get the literature that way, but to try to be a member of a lot of journals is just, it's not feasible. Right. And it's way more feasible to have a network of people you trust and say, hey, we're going to collectively try to share information to make this profession better. And I'm fortunate to kind of have some colleagues to do that with.
Cool. Well, I appreciate your honesty in sharing that, man.
Yeah. Facebook is good for more than just, you know, our drama.
That's right. What's your best advice for someone that is considering physical therapy school? Is there anything that you wish you had known before you went in, or?
Yes. And I'd like to hear your answer on this too, given the fact of kind of your trajectory as kind of, you know, stepping away as a clinician. But I wish I would have had a better pulse on kind of the debt to income ratio, you know, and I think that's worth noting.
Yeah.
Grad school is nothing to be taken lightly, and I took it way too lightly. I thought, I have a lot of friends that go to grad school. It's just the next thing you do. You know, society tells you, you pursue the next step. And it was grad school. And so I really signed the dotted line before I really analyzed what the heck I was doing. Right. And before you know it, you're six figures in debt and with a degree, and then you're examining starting salaries in the $50,000 to $60,000 mark. And the numbers just don't add up.
Yeah.
To kind of dig yourself out of that hole and provide yourself the life of which you thought, you know, you were going to carve out for yourself. So just trying to be a little bit more mature and making that decision. And it's hard. It's hard when you're 18, 19, 20 years old to try to understand that stuff. Find someone that can help you make sense of it. I try not to deter people away from PT if they're super passionate about it, because as we talked about on this show, I think the ball is in our court for really making change for people who are in pain and who are hurting. I think we're best suited to do that. So I don't want to turn people away from it, but at the same time, really examine, you know, the current state of the profession, like we talked about, and where you really see yourself going, to have a successful and fulfilling career.
All right. So I have a couple of, good kind of closing questions that I typically ask, but before I do, is there anything that you want to mention about your website or anything that you have going on that the audience should know about?
You know, if you're interested in the courses that we talked about, like we said, you can go to ice.physio, simple as that, ice.physio, and you can see all the course listings there for what we believe is creating Physical Therapist 2.0. There's a lot of live and online versions of courses, anything that fits your schedule. Give us a look. Our gym is CrossFit Tuabor West. And you can find my clinic, Fitness TX, which stands for treatment. I've had that question a lot. What's the TX stand for? Well, it's shorthand for treatment. So
I should have asked that, but I mean, I did kind of figure that, you know, when I saw it was Fitness TX. Okay. I got it.
Yeah. Clinicians know that shorthand. It slips the mind of everyone else, but yeah, so you can look me up, Fitness TX, or I put a lot of stuff on my Instagram there, and you can just find me at Dr. Mitch DPT on Instagram. Try to kind of keep you posted on my day-to-day life. And I try to be super authentic with that. I like to post my training to let you know that I'm in the ringer, just like every other strength coach and athlete is. I like to post, you know, quick iPhone tips of things that I found helpful every now and then, and maybe put out a polished video that goes up on YouTube as well, but try to keep it raw and keep it authentic. You know, I think too many people show the roses and they don't show the other side of things as well. So I'll put my failed lifts up there. I'll put my days when I'm having a little temper tantrum with the barbell. And I think we all go through that at times. So I try to keep it real on there.
Cool. So let me actually ask you about your training. That was one question I did want to ask in here before my closing questions. Do you train primarily as a CrossFitter, or do you tend to focus a little bit more towards weightlifting or basic barbell training, powerlifting, anything like that?
And that's a great question theoretically, because I think as you examine the progression of CrossFit, you know, I always looked at it like CrossFit's this bubble over here to the right, and powerlifting's this bubble over here to the left, and Olympic lifting was down here in the corner, and bodybuilding hypertrophy work was kind of off to the side. And as it's developed, you've seen these spheres kind of converge a little bit more, and a lot more rather. And so my weekly training, we follow training that's developed by Matt Chan and Eric O'Connor, who are former games athletes. Their company is called Train for the Win. So they do the programming for our affiliate as well as us as athletes. And so we follow basically a 90-minute session of, you know, CrossFit focused, but within the week, we have a couple days dedicated to weightlifting on the front end. We have a couple days dedicated to some hypertrophy accessory work on the tail end. So every day we're hitting some sort of conditioning piece. You know, typically one day a week, we're stretching a long interval piece out there or something, a long metabolic or monostructural piece in there. But yeah, we're typically touching some weightlifting on the front end, hitting a hard Metcon where we're really pushing the intensity in our training group, trying to get better, and then finishing out with some hypertrophy accessory work, whether that be gymnastic focused, whether that be hypertrophy focused. And we're seeing a lot more of that with integrating some more stuff like single arm rows, you know, some bent over barbell work, trying to get some horizontal pulling in our workout. Maybe that be single arm kettlebell work, trying to get some unilateral stuff in there. So the development of CrossFit, I've really enjoyed seeing because it blends a lot more of these approaches together. And that's kind of what our training typically reflects.
Okay. I probably should have asked that question earlier because I could keep asking a lot of questions, I'll leave it at that. All right. So one of my favorite questions to ask is what's a book that has impacted you the most?
Oh, man. Start with why. Because after I read that book, things really started changing, and maybe it found me at the right time, and maybe it was when I was searching for some stuff. But Simon Sinek, Start With Why, and you can just check out his TED Talk on that and get the synopsis for that.
Yeah.
Second to that has been Kelly's book. I give Kelly props anytime I can, really, because I feel as though he's put out so much content that's helped me so much. That I tell people I've graduated from the Star at University, you know, at the same time I graduated right. from University of Michigan. So, yeah. I give him and all of his hard work with Ready to Run and becoming a supple leopard and desk bound. I give him a lot of credit and his information he's compiled.
Absolutely. Great, great stuff. Final question. I hope your brain is not fried after all this.
Not at all.
But, what is the big takeaway action for the audience after hearing our session? So whether someone is a coach or an athlete or maybe someone that's thinking about physical therapy school, I think you've given a lot of actions actually, but what's the walk away thing for the audience here?
My bias is always move, you know, and train. And if you don't have a training practice, if you don't have a movement practice, if you don't have some way of constantly exposing yourself to things that you're not good at, related to movement in your physical self, I think you really need to examine that and get the ball rolling on that. And if you are someone who has a training practice, maybe you're like, yeah, I'm a runner. And I encourage you to step into your discomfort somewhere else. And whether that be picking up a barbell. And that's what I love so much about CrossFit is that I am not a stinking runner. And when that 5K shows up, I'm just as mad about it as everybody else in the class. But I put on my running shoes and we go hammer out a 5K. And on the days where there's a heavy, you know, barbell complex or something, I get a little bit more excited. But, you know, I love the diversity in the level playing field at which CrossFit is for that reason of always taking a step into your discomfort and being a little uncomfortable with one part of the workout. You know, the other day had hang power cleans, push-ups and box jumps. And I felt really good about the first two. And the box jumps were just, man, I wish they weren't in the workout, you know? And I like that piece of CrossFit is it's always going to push me into my discomfort. So if you're someone who has a moving practice, if you don't have a movement practice, look to find one. If you do have one, look to add some components to it or examine some others. That's going to encourage you to step into areas you weren't prior. And as a result, be a better athlete, be a better mover. And if you're a clinician, you'll be a better clinician from having done that.
Mitch, do you have a simple example of a movement practice that could be applicable for, you know, a majority of people? Maybe, I don't know if you mean like a kind of a warm up type movement preparation. Is there something that
I really mean like CrossFit specifically, like exposing okay. yourself to loaded movements, to full range of motion, to gymnastics, bodyweight movements. You know, yoga is a good, you know, good way to expose yourself to some ranges of motion like that and things of that nature. And that's another one where like I got to force myself to do a Ramwad every now and then. Yeah, I would rather not yeah. work on my middle splits, but I think it's important. So yeah. Things of that nature, it's just going to expose you to full range of motion, expose you to tissue loading,
And as a result, get you a more robust human that can do more things. And I think at the end of the day, that's important.
Got it. So work on being a better mover overall.
Yeah.
Good deal,
yeah, absolutely.
Man. Cool. Well, Mitch, this has been great, man. Thank you for being very open and honest about everything you're doing. And man, awesome success you're having with your cash-based clinic. I think that's awesome. And kind of integrating everything as a clinician and a coach and as an athlete. And again, that's why I wanted to have you come on, because I'm so impressed with people like you that are bringing and kind of bridging these gaps and meshing everything together like what you're doing. So thank you so much, man. It's been great.
Well, thanks so much for having me, man. And right back to you, thank you so much for all the content you've put out. Don't underestimate the work that you do, because, man, I can tell you countless drives to and from school that I've been scrolling who your next guest is and downloaded and just getting that content in on the way while I'm going to get more content. So cool. Thank you so much to you and to all your listeners who make your show go around, because it's important work.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that session with Mitch and got a lot of value out of it. He, again, is one of these new breed physical therapists that I have talked about before, and that is why I was really excited to have him come on the show. To check out the show notes, make sure to go to ardellatraining.com, and you can find the links to the resources that we talked about. Specifically, there was an open source paper that he talked about in regards to periodization. So I put a link to that in the show notes, so make sure to check that out. Guys, as far as the resource I mentioned in the opening segment, I am reading a book right now. Actually, I'm just finishing this. I am down to literally last couple pages here. It's a great book, and I think it's very appropriate as we kick off a new year. And that book is called Your Best Year Ever by Michael Hyatt. So this book just came out, and I read it in just a couple of days. Like I said, I'm just finishing the book right now, and it is fantastic. It's a book about setting, tracking, and implementing goals in any area of your life. So I highly recommend this one. Many actionable takeaways for me, and at the end of each chapter are simple action guides that you can use and apply and get things going to have your best year ever. So check that out. I'm going to sign off this week, guys, and we will be back next week. We'll talk again soon. Take care.